The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better. Have you ever dated someone who was bad for you? Who maybe brought out the worst in you or reinforced habits you were trying to break? I think we do this at work. I think that we can get into relationships with employers who are bad for us. And sometimes we feel like it's because we're being successful, right? We are working at the best places. Burnout culture is everywhere, but how much of it can we attribute to hard-driving cultures versus our own notions about hard work and success? Especially for those of us anxious achievers, the line can get blurry. And the stress can severely affect our mental health, no matter who's the contributing factors, right? It's something on the mind of both of our guests today as well. Sarah Green Carmichael is a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and Callie Williams-Yost, an author and founder and CEO of the Flex Strategy Group. They both joined me recently on a LinkedIn Live, and we talk about the interplay between company culture and individual experience and behavior. We talk about whether you can separate broader workplace cultures from the individuals who work there. And we'll go through some really practical ways to help ask yourself these questions and manage the stress. I would really love to hear your thoughts on this topic. And I'd love you, please leave us a review if you like the show, or write me on LinkedIn and tell me what you think. So Sarah, set us up here. We are going to talk today about the sort of woolly middle of like where culture meets individual behavior and how sometimes it's really hard to tease the two apart, especially when it comes to cultures of overwork and perfectionism and burnout and all that stuff. I'd love you to set us up, Sarah, because it was your article in Bloomberg Opinion that really spurred this. Give us a brief overview about the Goldman Sachs lawsuit that you wrote about and why it sort of inspired you to put pen to paper and talk about this stuff.
So over the winter, a former Goldman Sachs employee filed suit against the firm for what he claimed was the firm's relentless workload, bullying culture, and overall lack of support, which he said drove him to have depression, heart problems, even suicidal thoughts. So a host of physical and mental struggles. And what I thought especially was interesting and really made me want to write about this was the firm's response in the legal documents. The firm said, and I quote, "If he felt pressure, it was self-generated. It was not imposed on him. If he did work excessive hours, this was not because it was required or expected of him." And finally, that he burned out because of his self-imposed workload. So I thought this was actually almost unintentionally funny. I mean, like, we're obviously talking about a very serious topic, and this person has said that he has suffered seriously, but the idea that it would not be expected or required at a top investment bank to work excessive hours, just so, that this was all kind of his own idea, just sort of struck me as not really credible. And so what I sort of became interested in was how a workplace, how do we contribute to workplace cultures? How do we unintentionally reinforce them? And then how do those cultures kind of cycle around and come back to bite us? I think sort of like any dysfunctional relationship, there is a little bit of work to be done probably on both sides. But this was also a case where I thought this company hired this person because of his probably meticulous, conscientious, perfectionistic, hardworking ways. And then they sort of turned around and blamed him for being exactly who he was that they liked when they hired him.
And not only that, he wasn't an entry-level employee.
That's right. We often associate this kind of thing with Gen Z or millennials. This was a 55-year-old senior executive at the firm. So he was seasoned. He was in a position where he was recruiting other people into the firm. It was remarkable to me that someone with this level of experience would feel confident in making this kind of charge.
Callie, what did you think about it?
Well, Sarah and I had a long conversation about it. I wasn't surprised. And I think Sarah has the right analysis, which is what is the contributing factor on the side of the organization and what's the contributing factor on the side of the individual. And an organization like Goldman Sachs could say, hey, you know, this is just how we work here. And you know what? If you can't do it, there's probably a million other people who are willing to do it. And you know what? That's just the way it is. I think there is something that we can do as individuals within which any culture we work in. We can find perhaps a better way to fit work and life together around the edges of that culture. But as an individual, to be able to truly affect change in that culture, we have a limited ability to do so on our own. And that's where perhaps what worked at some point for him working at Goldman Sachs, clearly it was not anymore. And that's where you may have to decide to do something else to sustain your well-being. But then as an organization, if that's happening over and over again, is that something that's going to allow you to continue to perform at a high level as an organization? That's really the question.
Right, right. At some level, if a man walks into a bar once and gets in a fight,
right,
it may be the bar, but if he keeps going to bars and getting in fights.
Right. Exactly.
Yes.
I mean, I'm of two minds here because I do think that, and you wrote about this too, Sarah, there is an element of it, like attracts like, when you get to these like super high achieving, super high pressure workplaces. But I also think that a lot of people who only know how to be anxious achievers go to places like Goldman or law firms or med school or consulting firms or wherever, frankly, these days, most places are increasingly high pressure and apply habits they've been working from for decades. And the firm applies their expectations. And it's just,
yes,
like you said, it's a dysfunctional relationship.
Yes. You really helped me think this through too, Maura, because I think something you said to me for a different column is people work super hard when their self-worth is on the line. And I think that these companies know that. They like hiring people who work like that, right? Because you're so self-motivating, you're self-disciplining, like you're going to put it all out there because it's sort of scratching that itch that lets you know, I'm good enough, I'm doing okay, I'm being validated because I can say I work for XYZ, you know, gold star company. But it can become a kind of trap where you then don't think that you can be successful any other way. And that includes the company itself. They think we can't succeed unless we keep working this way.
That's why in my first book, Workless Life, Finding the Fit That's Right for You, there's a whole section on intentionally redefining success for yourself. And that's part of the problem is that we don't know that when for this gentleman, clearly from a health perspective, this is not working for him anymore. And how do we allow ourselves to fundamentally rethink and reset how we define success across the various dimensions that matter to us? And that has to be something we need to be talking about more as a society and allowing individuals to do that as they need to make a change that works for them if they cannot find it in their organizations. The other piece of this is not a new problem.
No.
This is something we've been talking about way before COVID. And it was funny. It's always sort of pegged on young people. Like before COVID, it was Gen X, okay, millennials. Now post-COVID, it's Gen Zs. And what I would say many times, it have been quoted many times for a long time, is young people are just talking about something that we need to be talking about. They don't always have the right language to talk about it. So it's interpreted as, I don't want to work hard. That's not what they're saying. They're basically saying, what are the boundaries between work and life? And if you are a doctor or you are a lawyer or you are working at an investment bank, you get it. Like you're working hard, you're fine. But you want to know, okay, when can I stop? Like, when is it okay for me to go and get my laundry and, you know, get my mail and go out with a friend? And that's been interpreted by leadership as, you know what, you just don't want to work hard. It's like, that's not really what they're saying. And this goes back more, we can get into this later. The whole problem with the balance word is just B-A-D bad, because you're never going to have a balance when you work at Goldman Sachs, but you could have a better work-life fit working in that context of that culture in a way that's healthy and supports high performance. And so how does an organization make that change? We've seen it. Organizations that come to us have done it. But you know what it takes? It takes a leader. It takes a leader mm-hmm. who's willing to say, you know what? I may have done it that way, but we're not going to do that anymore.
Here's the boundary.
It's not sustainable. And so how can we reimagine all of this in a way that allows us to still perform as a business, but keeps our people whole and feeling good about being here?
I mean, Sarah, do you think Goldman in essence was saying, no, we're not going to give you a boundary? No, that's not what we're about.
I think it's hard to say in this specific case without digging more into the details, but I do think that companies here they often talk out of both sides of their mouths. They will say things like, take the time you need. We support you. We're going to help you achieve, you know, your potential. It all sounds very soft and fluffy and sort of supportive. But then when push comes to shove, it's like, okay, well, we're going to need this back by Monday. And you're like, what's my sister's, you know, wedding this weekend? They're like, well, we're just going to need this back by Monday. How you get it done is up to you. So I think there's like a level of sort of cognitive dissonance there that I think it's understandable that employees don't quite know what to say. And I think it's possible to kind of continue because I think for both the company and the individual, the costs of working this way tend to be delayed, but the rewards are immediate. So the company says, thank you. Your boss is thrilled. It's only years later that you end up divorced or the company realizes they have a huge turnover problem or whatever it is.
Actually, can I just follow up on that point really quick? When you talked about the weekend work, that feels a little bit like that's changed from my perspective. I do think companies they've wised up a little bit on the crazy deep. It's more insidious now. I don't know. Does that feel right to you? Or do you think the sort of like, I expect you to work the weekend, figure it out mode is still predominant?
I think it depends probably on the sector. Client services still seem very much this way.
Yeah. Although they talk a great game.
They talk a great game. And they now have lots of things like, you know, oh, we have, you know, mental health counseling you can tap into, or you could take a leave of absence. They've tried to add these things that they think then makes it feasible for people to work 24/7 all the time with no break.
So that's the difference between what you say you want to do, but then actually doing the work to change the culture and the operating model to align with what you're saying. And that's the hard work. And that's what organizations have just resisted doing. And almost the pandemic sort of forced this massive disruption of the work model. And now we're sort of putting the Humpty Dumpty pieces back together, but some of that lingering DNA is still holding on. And this is the real opportunity in this moment to finally reimagine a lot of this stuff. But again, it goes back to leadership wanting to take that step. So,
I mean, I'm also hearing people saying that post-pandemic, they're seeing trends away from sort of our workaholic default. I think this is very sector specific. I'm not seeing it, but I definitely, the language has changed profoundly, as we were just saying. So Kelly, what's the disconnect? I mean, if we were on a maturity curve here mm-hmm. of companies at least are talking differently, where are they lagging? What behaviors are lagging when it comes to trying to better acknowledge the whole person? Because they are. They really, I think, are.
They are. It's how do you execute that?
Right.
I just think there's an execution problem right now. And I think first of all, they tried policy. Okay, let's put a policy in place. And that's not working. So, all right, now what do we do? And we're sort of in this middle zone where we're grappling with what that looks like next. And it's ultimately going to require, again, that leadership saying, all right, you know what? We need to do this differently. I am going to create the space and provide the resources and the sponsorship to go ahead and start to experiment with new ways of working. But then a lot of this innovation is going to have to happen at the team level mm-hmm. because even within an organization, you're not going to have one size fits all. So I'll give an example of an investment bank. So an investment bank historically has made, let's say, analysts just sit there between deals, right? Like you work all night, three nights in a row, but you know what? The norm could be, but when you're done, go home.
Right.
And when we need you again, come back. And in the meantime, take a nap, go run, whatever. So you have to have a leader that's going to say, that's how we're going to experiment with how we're working. You don't just have to sit here, even though that's how I did it.
Right.
Okay. But that's going to have to happen within different deal teams because you have different clients. You have some are international, some aren't. So one size is not necessarily going to fit all in terms of what that work innovation is going to look like. And then it gets down to the individual. Then we have to train individuals because those become the parameters that you are operating within. But then as the individual, we have got to train people to be intentional about how they are prioritizing their work and then the other parts of their life within those parameters that have been set. And we are not teaching people how to be intentional about what they need to get done at work and what they need to get done in their life, just sort of that day-to-day. My second book is Tweak It, about how to do that. But then if you need to reset, you need to fundamentally reset your work-life fit, as that gentleman from Goldman clearly did.
Yeah.
How do you work that through that so that maybe you could do that with your current employer, or how do you make it work at someplace else?
Right.
So those are really the steps we have to go through in execution. That takes effort, that takes resources, that takes commitment, and an awareness on the part of leaders and organizations that this is really the next level of change, and we're just not there yet for most organizations.
I want to pick up on maybe a couple of themes that Callie was talking about there, because I think what I see is I see a lot of effort going into saying things to managers like model better behavior, but managers are super busy. They don't feel like they can do that. To employees, you know, set better boundaries, but this puts so much of the burden on the individual to try to just fight the tide, right?
Can I just say something about the boundaries thing? I just have to get on my soapbox. I couldn't agree more. I wrote about this, like I used to have a really pretty boundary slide in my presentations and it was really cute and people liked it. And then I started, someone at a law firm like really took me to task and was like, stop. Why don't people just stop already with the boundaries? Hmm. It's you come in, you get us excited, you leave. We don't have the power.
Yeah. No, I'm glad that you mentioned that because I think it can be very frustrating to people. Sometimes it's helpful. So I think it's probably worth leaving the slide with like an asterisk maybe.
I took the slide out actually.
There you go. But I think what's more fundamentally needed is like what Callie was talking about with experimentation, right? Like a fundamental shift to how the work itself gets done. And I'll give an example.
Please.
So if you think about industries with high paying jobs like airline pilots or pharmacists or anesthesiologists or tax accountants, those are jobs where there's a high level of training and workers can pretty much substitute in for each other as needed. If you are having an emergency appendectomy, you are not waiting for your favorite anesthesiologist. You are not calling that person back from their honeymoon. You know, you're just going to deal with whoever's there. And yet, you know, with a lawyer, you think, oh, I've got to have my person. You know, yes, we'll interrupt them. Call them during the birth of their first child, whatever it is. And so I think that a lot of the sort of, like, we can make this better if we figure out ways to make professionals more substitutable, if we change how the work is structured so that people can swap in for each other. And it doesn't have to mean the work, you know, becomes lower paid or less prestigious in some way. Like, we can achieve at a high level if we just think about this a little differently.
And it's interesting. I love that point. I call it relaying, you know, like one relay team comes out, you pass the baton. I was speaking with Kristen Masco, who was formerly at Google, about this because it's what they learned from their data centers, right? Like, you have to have a data center team, and Google's data center cannot go down. But one good data center team is theoretically the same as another good data center team, because you can't possibly work 24 hours a day, even though the data's right, to your point. But though we all three sort of come from jobs where it's like, oh, but they want me. It's about me. how do we? I mean, that's a real achiever shift. Although I guess not if you're a surgeon. I don't know. That's so interesting. It's such an interesting thought. Like, what if there was another great opinion editor who could swap out when you are done being brilliant for the day?
Well, in fact, there is. That's a great segue, Maura, because I'll say, you know, in a previous editing job, I was in a job where we all as editors managed our own pipelines. You know, we had great relationships with our authors, and it's a little bit of ego. We didn't ever want anyone else to work with our authors. They're our authors. But that meant that we had these huge pipelines and we were often then slow to get back to people, or we would spend weeks trying to get to the bottom of our pipeline to take a week off, then come back and be just where we started. Now I work in an organization that's very different. You know, if something comes in super late, you know, it could be that a colleague in another time zone is going to handle it. If I go on vacation, my ego has to take a back seat so that I can have time off. And one of my brilliant colleagues will handle it. And you know what? They will do just as good a job as I will. So there is a little bit of kind of checking your own ego, but also having the confidence that you're like high achieving colleagues, they can handle it.
So what you've just described, both of you, is the process of stepping back, looking at the work, and really intentionally asking how, when, and where do we do this best? And that's what I meant by setting those parameters, because parameters are different than boundaries. Okay, boundaries are something the individual sets. Parameters are something a team would set, or a business line would set within itself, that people then know that's how we're going to work. And that's the process that then allows people to be better about putting up boundaries, because they know where the parameters are. You know when you're expected to get back to somebody when they email you at 3 o'clock in the morning, or you know you're not emailing people at 3 o'clock in the morning, or you know you've set up front that if something comes up and I am off, here's who's going to cover for me, and this is how we're going to do it. And because we put everything on our collaboration platform, it's clear what the notes are. Like, you've put that parameter up that we are establishing a clear line of note-taking and process around different cases on the platform we use to manage our cases. So it's okay if somebody come in and can do the work for me. Those are all the steps that have to be laid out that organizations are not taking the time to lay out. And then you experiment within those initial parameters to begin to understand what's going to work and what's not. And right now, it all feels very secondary. Like, oh, we'll get to that. We're super busy right now. It's like, no, this is the work, what you need to be establishing. So to your point, the performance is sustained, but we're able to be effective whole employees in a reality that is fundamentally different than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah. And, you know, I looked to your point, like there is a real business case for doing this. I looked at a study where they examined what happened when highly valuable employees died. And, you know, we sort of have this joking, oh, anyone could be hit by a bus. We need a succession plan for this. But it's true. Like, people could be hit by a bus tomorrow. And what is your plan? Or they could go to a competitor. Anyway, in this study that looked at employee sort of unexpected death, they found that in organizations that had invested in what you're talking about, Callie, where people could step in for each other, really didn't suffer much of a setback at all. I mean, people were sad, obviously, but the organization continued to grow. Organizations that had not done that work, it was disastrous for them.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
It's such a fundamental... I was like, that's un-American. You know, like, if we all can fit in for each other, well, what about me? I'm so special. I'm the one who graduated magna cum laude. You need me, you know? that's a really profound mind shift for both organization and anxious achiever.
I think it's about recognizing that we can be valuable without being completely indispensable.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yep. That's exactly right. Again, what's the definition of success? And I think there's an opportunity also here to maybe do a better job mentoring and developing the next level of talent, even just co-generational mentoring each other. Like, there's a lot of opportunity to help each other grow and be able to support the work so that it isn't as overwhelming as it is for so many.
Do companies have a responsibility to help their sort of up-and-coming stars to almost de-identify with the total obsession with work, with being the star? Like, is that something that we need to think about in leadership training?
I think that's a tricky one because, you know, obviously companies want that. They want you to be so identified. They want you to be a company man or woman. At the same time, you know, you could tell them, think about the long term, but also companies have become very reticent in thinking about employees as long-term investments. They sort of weirdly expect us like, oh, we're going to invest in this person and then they might just leave, go to our chief rival. So I would like to see a shift towards more long-term thinking where employees would feel better about staying with companies and also companies would feel better about giving them a reason to stay. But I don't think this short-termism works for anyone, but it's kind of like, again, like a bad relationship. Someone's got to go first to try to make it better.
Hmm. And this goes back to what is leadership in a flexible, dynamic work reality that you're working across workplaces, spaces, time, and have to be really intentional and collaborative. Are we training leaders to be effective in developing their talent and collaborating and coordinating? I personally think there's a lot of work to do with that. I'm not sure we've updated what those skills and competencies need to be.
We're also at a time when so many organizations are just slashing the ranks of their mm-hmm. middle management. I mean, keep seeing layoff headlines in the news, and it's often then a tech CEO or someone saying, well, what do the middle managers do anyway?
Right.
So I think there's all this pressure on managers to be like a player coach, to do a line job and also manage people. That does not leave a lot of time for tailoring your approach to each person that you manage in a way that's going to help them thrive.
Right. And it's hard to make change when you're scared, you know, for your job.
Well, I just think again, just one quick, I think we need middle managers, which is why Sarah fascinated. I love that you're writing about this at a time when you even need more coordination and deliberateness around how, when, and where work is being done, that they're cutting managers is just makes no sense to me at all. And then that means, to your point, managers can't be all things. That's even more important that the individual employee needs to be a partner in that process. And we need to task and prepare individuals to play that role as well.
Yeah. And I think also what I'm hearing you say is that there's a healthy dose of skepticism that we need to start building in. I mean, this is sort of like, duh, before we give everything we have to our job.
Yes. And I think that's, one of the workaholic scales that I like to use actually doesn't ask you about the hours you put in at all. It's all about how you feel mm-hmm. about your job. Do you do things like sneak to the bathroom to secretly answer emails on date night? You know, have you lied to your family about, you know, yes, exactly. Yes, I know, right? It's the kind of like, if work is keeping you up at night, if you're lying to your family so that you can sneak off and work, if you feel super frustrated when something blocks you from working, like, you know, a bad Wi-Fi connection, you know, that might be a signal that like it's too central in your sense of self, even if you're not putting in tons of time.
I need to post that, Sarah. That actually is a quiz I probably should take.
And you know what? That's a signal that you may have to reset how your work and life is fitting together, because it may have worked for, and this is why there's no one size fits all, right? Like, it might have been fine for a period of time, but then now it's not. And so I always tell people, first, try to make those small adjustments and see if you can make it better. But if you can't, you may have to think about what the next situation is going to look like and how you are going to redefine success for yourself and find a fit that's more appropriate for what you want right now. Because some of those things you're describing, Sarah, to me are those signals that the fit's no longer working and it might have worked before and now it's not. And I think that's another thing we don't realize is that it's going to change over the course of our career. And to be flexible with that, because work-life fit's a verb. It's not a noun. And it's not, this is where balance gets people off track. It's not a 50-50 split between your work and your personal life. And that is something that we struggle with when we think the goal is balance. It's not. And yeah, it's really something that you can change.
Kelly, one of the things that you taught me, thankfully, much earlier in my career was that if there were times when I did want to sneak into the bathroom because I had such a great idea for the book I was writing or I was, you know, starting a business and I was so excited about it, that that was okay too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to me, I'm always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the line between sort of anxiety, which is so natural that a lot of us feel this now. Am I going to get laid off? Is AI going to take my job? Am I good enough? Like, I have to check my email because if I don't, someone will miss me, versus, oh God, I'm loving this deal. This is really exciting and innovative. This is a season in my life where I'm going to give it my all.
And this is why what you do is so wonderful and so important, because you really help us understand how to parse between those two things, which can feel very much the same. Yeah. Oftentimes, you know, again, I'm a big believer that in today's world, and you know this about me, you have to have some kind of a mindfulness practice, or you have to have a way to be consistently checking in with yourself on a regular basis, so that you can begin to know the difference for yourself. And some, you're never going to be perfect. Like, there's always going to be times you're stressed out, and there's always going to be times it's a little anxious and what have you. It's when it becomes too much. And it is no longer feeding you, and you do feel overwhelmed. And maybe you're getting sick, or maybe your relationships are starting to suffer and you don't feel like a great partner. You don't feel like a great parent. You don't feel like a great friend. That's when you start to say, okay, like, how do I have to do things differently? And really, you and I know this, I've talked about this more. Small things make a really, really big difference. And that's what I've learned over the years from people I call the work-life fit naturals. They are just like masters of the small tweak that really goes a long way. So try that first. And you might be surprised, but again, you may have to make a more fundamental reset down the line, and that's okay too.
I try to ask myself, what is my goal? Like, and like the end goal, what's the impact I'm having? Because I think that I tend to get excited about work. I tend to think about work a lot outside of work hours, and that feels good. Mm-hmm. I guess what I try to focus on is like, am I excited about something that's going to have an impact? You know, one of my colleagues was talking the other day about how he worries too much that people aren't working enough, that hours worked have actually declined. And he gave this example of Honoré de Balzac, this like, you know, incredible French novelist and writer. He would stay up all night writing. Well, left unsaid in this conversation was that Balzac died at the age of 51 of a massive heart attack. So like, maybe that was worth it for him because he is now one of the great French writers of all time. If what I am working on is not going to leave me as one of like the great business opinion columnists of all time, then maybe it's not.
You are.
Maybe it's not. I would say, Sarah, you're pretty darn good. I got
to. You know, so I just try to keep a little perspective. Like, there are people who have sacrificed a lot and achieved great things. But if it's something where it's like, it's really just an email, or it's really just helping another company make some money by moving some numbers on a spreadsheet, then maybe I don't need to sacrifice my health or my family to this. But if it's something that genuinely excites me and is a great long-term goal that I'm really proud of, then maybe it is actually worth some of those other costs.
Mm-hmm. That goes back to that definition of success. What is it? And what is it for you? And I know for me, over my career, it's changed. Like, it's what I thought was success 15 years ago is different than it is today. And so how do we give ourselves permission to just continually be revising and then adapting how our work and life fit together to match that definition?
That's right. That's right. And I think the company used to fill that role if you were sort of a lifer. I know a lot of people who've been at companies for decades and they're like, yeah, well, I had my second kid. I sort of pulled back and they moved me to this job. But now I'm a partner because my kids have left home. Right. That's sort of gone. And it's like the impetus is on us a little bit more to modulate, which is hard. But I know we can do it. Okay, last question. I think all good change starts with good questions. And I'd love to hear from you both. If I'm a leader and I'm feeling inspired and I'm ready to change how we work, or if I'm an individual person feeling like I just can't do this anymore, my hair is falling out, what are some good questions that I should start as I start thinking about how to make change?
I would say I like Callie's approach of experiments. So the question I would have is just, what would happen if? Mm-hmm. What would happen if I didn't respond to this email in the morning? What would happen if we didn't work with this client who was a nightmare last time? You know, like, so I would just try to create enough of a pause that you could ask, what would happen if? And if it's something you have the power to do in that moment and see how it goes, what would happen if I didn't check email this entire vacation? See what's going to happen. And if it's something that requires sort of more of a discussion, you know, maybe raise that discussion with colleagues or your boss, but I think it's worth asking.
What would happen if I let the trading desk go home because we've just, I don't know. I don't know what happens with trading.
Because the market closed and really all we're doing is just throwing paper airplanes at each other. And now, okay, go home.
That was my life on political campaigns.
Yeah.
You're expected, because it's the culture, you're expected to literally live at the office. But you know what? Even politics sleeps sometimes.
Yep.
Callie, what about you?
So the question I would encourage a leader to just focus on is simple, but very powerful. Start with what do we need to do? Start with the work. Mm. What are you trying to achieve as an organization? And then how, when, and where do we do that best? And by answering the how, which is usually around technology and process, the when, which is really about, could be about time, but also when we're interacting in real time, when it's asynchronous, and where, meaning on site, remote, do we do that work best? From that question, you'll begin to define those parameters within which people will operate, and they'll do it with you. So it's not you coming top down. They're doing it with you, which gives them an investment in what that's going to mean for them and for the business, and then experiment within that structure. So I love what Sarah said for individuals. 100%, you need to experiment and try, because you'd be surprised as an organization. That's the way you start to reimagine how, when, and where work is done, to just perform as an organization effectively today, but then help your people be their best as well.
That's it for today. Our show is produced and edited by Mary Du. Our assistant producer and sound engineer is Nick Krinko. Many thanks to the LinkedIn Presents family and to all our guests for sharing their stories. If you love the show, tell your friends. I would love you to leave a review, because they really matter in helping the show get found. You could also follow us or subscribe. If you have a question for me or you want to submit an idea for the show, find me on LinkedIn, where you can follow me, message me, I promise I'll write back, or subscribe to my newsletter for more from the anxious achiever world. Thanks for listening.